The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show, EDU edition. We're going to go off in a little different direction today. The last few shows, EDU shows at least, have been focused on investment positioning, at least that's what we call it. It's our form of asset allocation in preparation for the distribution needs in retirement. And today we're going to talk a little bit, we'll call this a dialogue show because we're going to address some feedback and questions that we've gotten about our process. So we're going to be focused on how people are interpreting our process and approach and questions and feedback that they might have. And next week, this will be a good lead-in show to next week where we'll talk a little bit more about retirement planning in general with a special guest that we're going to have on. Kevin Sebesta from the Rock Retirement Club is retirement coach in the club. And he's going to join us next EDU show next week to talk about some topics that we usually don't cover on the show. So we like to bring in outside people with kind of different perspectives on different elements of retirement planning that we may not focus on. There's a lot of things to consider, a lot of decisions to be made, a lot of emotions and lifestyle transitions, etc., that happen in retirement. And he offered to come on and chat a little bit about that. So looking forward to having Kevin on next week. So Jim, I know, has assembled together a few emails from listeners that were wanting to chat with us a bit about our planning approach. And so we'll rely upon him to bring those into the show today. And we'll kind of, I don't know how many we'll get through, but we'll just see where the tides take us today and discuss what we can about our general philosophy and approach to retirement planning, which is, if you've been listening for a while, you know that it's fairly unique. So, Jim, ready to go?
Thank you, Chris. Yeah. And welcome, everybody, to the EDU version of the Retirement and IRA Show. As Chris has mentioned, I'm Jim, otherwise known as Jim Salnier. And today's show, again, we're going to kind of dive into a couple of email questions we got about our approach. But before I do, I want to acknowledge that the Q&A show that came out
right.
On Saturday was inadvertently linked to the first show of 2025 in January, the first week of January 2025. That was not a reflection of your podcasting app. I want to thank everyone. We had a bunch of people email me that the show was playing the first show of the year. I want to thank everybody who reached out to me on that. Joe in our office has acknowledged she regrettably made an error. It was a human error. She has fixed it. So if you haven't yet downloaded last week's Q&A show, please do so. And I believe she did something that for those of you who actually subscribe to the service, or at least through Apple, she said it might work. it will have automatically downloaded the show again for you, so you would have the correct show playing. But don't quote me on that, and I don't know if it's truly going to work. So if you didn't get a chance yet to listen to last week's show, which was a tax-focused Q&A show with Jake and Paul from the office joining Chris and myself, you can do so. Anything you want to add on that, Chris, because you're far more techie than I am?
Yeah, it mostly affects people who download it automatically to their devices. It will have downloaded the wrong one initially, and on some of those, some devices, you need to manually ask it to re-download it again, and when you do that, you'll get the new show. So that's the quote fix if you're still hearing the wrong show when you try to listen to last Saturday's show.
All right, so hopefully that works for everybody, and you can actually hear last week's tax Q&A show. Yeah. Today's show, it's going to kind of be like a Q&A show, but it's not. It's definitely an EDU show. As Chris said, it's what we call dialogue. It's where we're just kind of sharing dialogue with you on our process and approach. And some of you will share, as you'll see, how you've taken our process and approach and changed it a little to your liking. Other people will have more specific, nuanced questions on our process and approach. All of them, not all of them, actually, I think there's one who's not quite a DIYer, but most of them are DIYers, do-it-yourself Vanguardians, as we call you guys. And we're just here, Chris and I, are just going to kind of chat back and forth to give our opinions. My opinion may differ from his may differ from mine. And Jake was going to try to be on today's show, but he couldn't. And I'm sure if he was, his opinion may differ as well. That's one thing that I've always valued here at the firm. I don't want people to feel we have to all wear the same or march to the same drum. Or isn't there a song, Marching to the Beat of a Different Drum, or something like that? We're not all going to march to the same drum. We specifically plan as a team, and there's five of us on the planning team, and we all think, speak, act differently. Now, there's many, many aspects to our process that for us, and me in particular as the founder of the firm, are non-negotiables, and we're not going to change them. But there's many aspects to what we do and how we approach retirement planning that do change, and change quite often, and should change 20 years from now, when I'm well into my late 70s, early 80s. If whoever is running this firm is still doing it the same way as I did 20 years earlier, they were a complete and utter failure. This process and your process, your approach to retirement, needs to change with the times. Nobody knows what the future is going to bring. Even when we produce an analysis, and it's been years since I personally have delivered a retirement analysis, I did train Jake not too long ago, so over the last 2 years, I may have sat in on some of his presentations, but it's been well over 4 or 5 years since I sat down one-on-one with a client and delivered their retirement analysis. But when I did deliver the retirement analysis, and for you DIY VGers, when you do your retirement analysis, you should begin by telling yourself the same thing I told everybody I was working with. Everything I'm about to go over with you is wrong. I don't know how Jake does it now, Chris, but why did I always lead with that?
Well, because when we're showing people a projection into the future, we're kind of trying to look into a crystal ball and predict what's going to happen. And reality is going to unfold differently one way or another. It would be actually shocking if the projection that you put together looking forward some 10, 20, 30 years turned out to be true. That would be a total fluke. That's just not going to happen. And these errors can be due to unforeseen events that come up, can be due to inappropriate or what turn out to be incorrect assumptions, right? What you assume to be the case turns out to be different. So you anticipated it. You were just off in your estimate. Or thirdly, it happens all the time. People start to behave differently than they thought they would. They actually intentionally make decisions that would send them off on a different path than what was projected initially. So that kind of makes it sound like you shouldn't even bother doing a projection. And that's not true. Not true at all. That's like, I joke with people all the time. I joke with students that, you know, when you're driving your car down the road, you're trying to get to a destination. So you're driving your car down the retirement road. You're trying to get to this destination, a successful retirement. And what if I told you, you know, it was super, super foggy out, that you're, you know, you're looking through the windshield because you're trying to see things coming that you might need to react to and maybe make emergency maneuvers if a deer jumps out in front of you or something. And if it's foggy or hard to see, you don't just throw up your arms and say, well, forget it. If I can't see perfectly clearly, it's not even worth trying. Retirement planning projections, I think, are the same way. We're going to peer forward. We have to understand that it's going to be foggy, that even though you've got a specific number projected 20 or 30 years from now, you got to take that with a grain of salt and realize there's a bunch of fog between now and then. And we still are going to try to peer through the fog and see as much as we can, because even the outline of things, the curve coming up, the deer jumping out in front of us, all those things, if we can get a hint of what's happening, we can be better drive the car, right? We're just in a much better position to do so. So that's kind of how I see it. I don't know if I've ever used that metaphor on the show before. I know I've used it in class, talking to people about forecasting and projecting into the future, but may or may not have used that on the show, and hopefully it makes some sense to people.
Well, I've used metaphors very similar to that. As far as investing goes, I used to always look, and I'm diverging a little, folks, but when Chris mentioned that, it got me to thinking of how I used to talk to people. And when we were talking about investment portfolios or projecting investment returns, I used to share with people that we as a firm, we create a forward-looking return projection, that we prefer to use forward-looking projections, not rearward-looking projections. Those, the rearward ones, the ones where you look at what the market has done over the past 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 plus years and draw conclusions that if this is what's happened in the past, ergo, it's got to happen again in the future. Whereas a forward-looking return projection, and we take an average from buy-side analysts, sell-side analysts, and independent analysts. If you don't know what any of that means, Google it. I don't want to waste time getting into what a buy-side, sell-side, and independent analyst are. But we use two of each for a total of six, and we take their average. But they're giving us, or they don't give us, we subscribe to it, but we get their forward-looking projections of asset classes. Then Travis, the gentleman who helps us design our portfolios and do the due diligence, will weight them based on our accumulation portfolios, which are modeled very similar to Morningstar target risk benchmarks. And it gives us forward-looking. My analogy to where I'm going with this is I would tell people, when you drive home today from my office, are you going to be looking out the windshield, or are you only going to be staring at your rearview mirror as you're trying to go forward? So when you use returns based solely on what's happened in the past, I don't think it's fair or good. Now, there's others who will argue this, especially you VGers, till the cows come home. I don't need the email, unless you have nothing to do and you want to send me an email and tell me why I'm wrong and why looking at the past makes more sense than trying to look at what the future may bring. But I've always felt when you're using return assumptions, you should be reflecting what's happening now and what's realistic to happen in the coming years. We haven't had 30-something trillion of debt. We haven't seen different types of volatility and other issues that are going on now, and to base them solely on what's happened in the past. I'm having a dialogue discussion with a gentleman now on bonds. He doesn't know this. I haven't replied back to him yet. But one of the things that I'm going to point out to him in a very well laid out assessment that he did on 5-year bonds is why I was actually referencing and talking about the performance of 30-year bonds and how 30-year bonds in 1981 had reached the pinnacle of their height of almost 16% in yield and dropped all the way, I think it was around 2020-ish, somewhere around there, 21-ish. I forget, I don't have it right in front of me, when the 30-year dropped to less than 1% briefly, but it dropped. when you have a near 40-year period where interest rates go from 16 to less than 1, that causes the appreciation of bonds, in my opinion, to be... That's where I want to go with this. Let me rephrase that, folks. It doesn't mean the next 40 years, the capital return of bonds is going to do the same, because we all know when interest rates go down, the price of bonds goes up. So if the past 40 years bonds did this, and you're taking the rearview mirror performance of bonds and you're going to project it going forward, I don't think you're doing yourself any good. Instead, you should be looking and saying, wow, we've got $36 trillion in debts growing at over $2 trillion a year. How are we going to pay for this? Globally, the world is in debt. What's going to happen with all of that? What's the valuation of equities right now relative to historic norms? When you start looking at a lot of these things, you do have to question, will returns over the next 30 or 40 years be representative of where they were over the past 30 or 40 years? So I didn't mean to go down this road, but Chris did bring it up with his analogy. The point that I want everyone to understand, whether you're talking about projecting retirement the way I believe and I developed with what we call the secure retirement income process, you guys refer to it, rightfully so, the fund number approach to retirement planning. Whether you're going to use our process, the safe withdrawal rate, a guardrail strategy, a ceiling and floor, or one that you've created on your own, y'all VG engineer style people with Excel spreadsheets, whatever you are projecting, keep a few things in mind. Similar to Chris's fog analogy, I used to talk about being in a boat. And if you're in a boat and it's foggy, you might only be able to see a couple of boat lengths in front of you. You know there's a whole lake or ocean if you're on the ocean out there, but maybe you're leaving the harbor and there's all sorts of impediments in your way, but you can't quite see them. You know they're out there, but you don't know. But you can feel fairly confident because maybe you can see half a mile in front of you. You feel, okay, I'm pretty confident over the next 20 minutes I'm okay, but I don't know what's coming beyond that. It's the same thing with your retirement projection. You may be saying, Jim, if everything in a retirement projection is wrong, why the hell do I want to do one? Really, because of two elements. First, in order to make decisions on how to much to spend, what to spend it on, what to project for your investments, how to do any of these decisions, when to claim Social Security, when to claim a pension, how much can you safely maybe gift to your children for a wedding or a house? In order to make any of these decisions, you've got to have some sort of reasonable representation of what's going on. And you can feel fairly certain your projections for the next 2, 3, 4, even 5, 6 years is fairly accurate. But yes, 10, 15, 20, 25 years into the future, not accurate at all. And you might be saying, why, if it's not accurate, would I want to do it or even count on it? Because of the law of large numbers. Law of large numbers simply says if you analyze enough data points, even if any one data point is wrong, even if all data points are wrong, collectively, the trends that those data points show are fairly accurate. And notice I use the words trends, because that's what you should be analyzing when you look at your own spreadsheets and your own projections, is what are the trends showing? In other words, I don't feel your, if you're a do-it-yourselfer, or our, if you're one of our clients, projections of what your minimum dignity floor expenses 20 years from now on any given expense that your MDF is comprised of, and there's going to be hundreds of them, if not thousands, any given one is most likely wrong. But collectively, the trend of that MDF is quite accurate. And that trend can then be weighed against the trend of any cost of living increase, actual known cost of living increase, or hypothetical projected, as long as it's hypothetical and projected on reasonably sound data, that projected MDF against that projected inflationary rate or growth rate is going to be fairly accurate. However, it lends to the importance of updating your retirement analysis on a semi-regular basis. We don't feel, for the most part, everybody needs to pay us to do a complete and full plan every year. But definitely by year three, you should update your plan, because so much will change in that three-year period that you never even acknowledged or knew. But there will be, and I think you'll agree, Chris, come a point in someone's life where they may not have to do a retirement analysis anymore. What do you feel on that?
I think that's true, because things simplify a bit. There's early on a lot of decisions to be made, but a lot of the decisions you're going to make, once they're done, that's the last time you're going to have to make that decision for the rest of your life. Take Social Security claiming, or, you know, what, how you're going to fund your delay period, or, you know, just those types of things aren't constantly in front of you having to be dealt with. At some point, a lot of things are just how they are. The decisions have been made. Plus, just like when you were having your career and you learned over time how to budget and how to pay your bills and how to live within your means and all that kind of stuff, that early on in your 20s, a lot of people had struggled with budgeting and figuring out, what could I spend on this? And is this too much? And what's a reasonable this and that? And, but you get good at it after a while. Everyone gets thrown kind of back into their 20s when they retire, because they're facing this new era where there's no longer a paycheck, and that is life altering. And they've got to deal with paying their bills in a different way, and also behaving differently, because they're no longer going to work and now they're retired and they're going off and doing all these things. And it takes a while to get in the swing of things. But I think if you talk to anybody who's been retired for 10 years, they're going to tell you they kind of got it. I mean, they've got it figured out again. They're kind of back in that comfortable mode that they were in when they were maybe 45 years old, having practiced living as a career salary person. And they're just, it's just a lot easier to handle. So there's certainly going to be issues that come up later in life, usually medical related issues or loss of a spouse and some traumatic events that can happen. So I'm not saying it's decision free, but things do calm down. And, once you're kind of in the swing of things, you have your assets, you know, where they need to be. You've got your expenses handled. You now are no longer predicting what you're going to spend on certain things. You know what you're spending on certain things. It just kind of becomes more comfortable. And then you don't need to do this deep analysis projection quite so much anymore. At least generally, there's always exceptions, but that's, I think, the general rule.
Right. And for tax planning, especially, most tax planning, during what we call the tax planning window, happens between retirement and when RMDs begin. Once RMDs begin, a lot of people's tax planning opportunities, not everybody, there's always anomalies, but for most people, it goes away. It's no different than when you're working and you're making a good salary. Tax planning opportunities are far more limited. Why? Because your brackets are being filled with all this income being driven by your labor. And it doesn't generally allow us to do tax planning, because any type of Roth conversions or distribution strategies or step up in basis strategies or whatever become diminished because your income is already too high to get any type of benefit. So for what we have seen, even tax planning starts to slow down, not tax prep. You're still going to need that. But for most of us, by time we get to that age, AI is going to be doing your tax prep, and it's not going to be any big deal anymore. But tax preparation will continue beyond RMDs, obviously. But tax planning generally stops after RMDs. Now, that doesn't apply to anyone. People with special needs children might need to continue to do some tax planning. to make sure that the special needs child can get some tax advantage income being left to their special needs trust, so the government doesn't take 50%+ of the money that they're trying to leave to their special needs child. So that type of tax planning may continue. Or for those who prioritize the one in our 210 tax ordering number, two being the couple, one being the widow-widower, zero being the beneficiary. Those of you who prioritize the one or the zero over the two may also continue to do some tax planning, albeit to a lesser degree, post-RMD age. But what I'm trying to get you to understand, because it ties into some of the questions, or I guess the first question we're going to get to, your situation as you age becomes easier from a planning perspective, maybe not from a cognitive perspective, but from a planning perspective, I think most of the strategizing and the difficulties are faced early in retirement, and it actually gets easier. Now, that doesn't mean you DIYers managing your own portfolio and your own spreadsheets and your own assets. That type of financial management's not going to get easier. It's going to get more complex. But tax planning strategies, hopefully your go-go money has already been spent on fun. So managing two types of fun pools, the go-go position and the slow-go and no-go position, that's over. Your delay period MDF, managing that position, which is the minimum dignity floor needs between retirement and, generally speaking, for most of you, age 70, when your Social Security benefits and other secure income is fully turned on, that is over with. Your post-delay MDF reserve may already be close to being utilized, or only has a few years left post age 70 before you're going to start consuming that position. And for those of you who choose to take that position and actually purchase a single premium immediate annuity to cover the income needs that that position was earmarked for, your life just became a hell of a lot easier. You no longer have to manage that position. As you age and maybe cognitively decline, or your spouse cognitively declines, and the insurance company is just going to send a check magically every month, every quarter, every year, however often you turned the income on. So you can see with our approach, the see-through portfolio concept, or any concept, even the safe withdrawal rate, or the guardrail, or the ceiling and floor, or any variant of that, also becomes easier. And sadly, it also becomes easier because you become closer to one important date that nobody truly knows. And what am I getting at there, Chris?
Well, the date we don't want to get to, the very Correct. End.
The very end. But the closer you are to the end, the easier it becomes to project. Using my analogy of a boat in the fog, or Chris's analogy of driving down the highway in the fog, the closer you get to your destination, the easier it gets, even though you were driving in fog or operating a boat in the fog. The closer you get to passing away, the fewer years you need to project, the closer you get to your life expectancy, the easier things get. So without a doubt, retirement planning is much more difficult on day one of retirement, far more easier, say, at age 80 or 85 in retirement. Now, I'm not saying it's going to be easier from a cognitive standpoint to manage your spreadsheets and your assets, but from a planning perspective, your needs change. It's no more about aligning your retirement to updating your reserves. Most people have four reserves. Three of your four are gone. Three of them are gone. You spent them. You lived long enough. You beat the system. Hopefully you spent your go-go on fun. It's gone. Your MDF delay period, gone. MDF post-delay period, hopefully annuitized. Three of the four main ones that people have are gone. It's getting easier, thankfully, because your brain capacity is not. Okay, that ties into this first question, Chris. It begins, and this came in last year. I am a longtime listener and VG'er nearing retirement. I have lots of spreadsheets and have tried to create one with a spending segmented strategy. To be honest, it is only marginally different from the time segmented strategy that Jim is so fond of differentiating. Did I nail it?
Yeah, there you go.
Perfect. Himself from. Everyone, watch Jim go down a rabbit hole now. No, listener, I'm not going to go down a rabbit hole now. I think I already did go down a few. My question. These are complicated spreadsheet strategies and it's complicated plan and system with lots of moving pieces. Some things that need to be done every year to adjust for markets and lifestyle changes. How do you suggest a VG-er? How do you suggest a VG-er people keep this as simple as possible and simplify it over time to account for our cognitive decline? Much of what he's asking, I think we've already answered. He says, you can stop there if you like, but since your dad, my dad, folks, could not do fractions in his 80s, how can I or my wife track the MIGAs, multi-year guaranteed annuities he's talking about, the MIGAs and buffer and reserves and guaranteed inheritance and all the rest that make adjustments as we go along? Okay, I can see why your client did not want to buy the trailer. What he's talking about there is what gave birth to the fund number concept and investment positioning. A gentleman who bought a truck and he was going to buy a trailer to have the truck pull 3 years later, because he and his wife, when they retired, their dream was to visit every national park in the lower 48. And I had to chat with him about feeling more comfortable to spend his money because his pension was covering a huge amount of his minimum dignity floor. Everything that we teach you, it just made me realize after working with this gentleman for well over a decade, it still wasn't resonating with him. Hence, it gave birth to the whole concept of the see-through portfolio and things like that. Okay. So what I would add to what this gentleman is saying, Chris, and you can feel free to add anything you want, obviously, is yes, you are correct. As you age, certain aspects are going to get more difficult, but some aspects are going to get easier. I think your spreadsheets will go the way of the dinosaur by the time you get into your 80s. You don't need all those spreadsheets. You're kicking up against life expectancy. If you followed everything the way we talk about, your MDF position for the delay period, gone. Your MDF position to cover your post-delay shortage, hopefully annuitized, making your life easier. But if not, that's going to be a decision the older you makes. And if the older you decides not to annuitize, it's because, number one, they feel cognitively able to handle it. Or, sadly, number two, they realize long-term life expectancy is no longer an issue. Something has happened. Maybe one of the two of you have already passed away and the survivor doesn't have much more longer, statistically speaking, to live. And you choose for the next 1, 2, 3, 4 years, I'm going to live off of withdrawals and not annuitize. But if you do decide to annuitize in the future, and remember, folks, these reserves that you do in our positioning concept, the post-delay MDF reserve, the responsibility of the younger you, the VG-er today, is to just figure out how much that should be. What discount rate are you going to use? How to invest those assets to meet or preferably exceed that discount rate? And then to monitor that reserve over the coming years to make sure its value still reflects what the older you will need to purchase an annuity. It is not specifically to buy an annuity. That decision you're not going to make. The older you is going to make. And they're not here yet. And when the time comes, the older you will decide if they're going to gasp by that dreaded annuity that you VGers hate, or for any number of reasons, decide, no, I'm going to just spend these assets down. But my point is now, and as I've been relaying in this whole tirade, it actually gets easier. A lot of what you list is not going to be as difficult as it is now. The biggest difficulty will be actually managing your portfolio. And yes, perhaps understanding your spreadsheets, but you won't need them at that point. Your life will become easier. Not managing your assets, but the complexities that you have been planning for from your 60s or 50s, if you retired in your 50s, through your 70s, all those complexities have been satisfied. What do you think, Chris?
Well, I think that the younger you does have an obligation or a duty to the older you to make things as simple as possible. And I want to mention a couple of them that we may not have mentioned recently. We've certainly talked about them in the past. But remember the whole reason we promote covering your minimum dignity floor with secure income. There's a couple of main reasons. One, it allows you to protect yourself from longevity risk as it applies to your minimum dignity floor because you're covering those important expenses with a lifelong stream of income that can't run out. So there's that beneficial aspect. But also the simplicity of it, in combination with something we probably don't mention as often as we should, and that is what Jim calls the two checking account strategy, which is to have all of your secure income flow into one particular checking account, and from that account you pay all of your minimum dignity floor expenses. And separately then you have an account that has your fun in it. That's a really easy way to have segregation between them so that things don't get muddied and mixed together. And then you have to worry about, am I spending money that on fun that should be going towards my minimum dignity floor? You keep them separate. And it's pretty simple to do. We're not talking about managing a whole bunch of different accounts, just two, right? And that's a good idea, I think, for people who are trying to keep those separate and also, you know, not leave any fun money on the table, that they know everything in this we can spend this year from this account because that's our fun account. And doing this isn't going to jeopardize our minimum dignity floor expenses where our secure income is flowing in there. So that's something to consider and maybe set up for the older you and practice it before you get older so you're used to using it that way. And then the second one is having clear instructions for yourself and others who might be helping you that say, this account is for this. This is why I have this money here. This is what is going to happen with this MIGA when it matures. This is money for my, you know, future secure income needs. And here's the considerations here. And I think it's good to kind of write your future self a note or a letter explaining it, because it can be useful for you to be reminded, because a decision might have been made 10 or 12 years prior that now you're going to, you know, now the time has come to use those dollars. But also someone might be helping you at that time and being able to just hand over, here's why my stuff is set up the way it is. So don't discount the need for what we might call in the estate planning world letters of instruction, but just formally it's a letter to yourself reminding you of what you're going to do there. So I do think there's things like that you can do that can help the future you understand what's going on, and you know, keeping it simple is always preferred.
Right. And don't lose sight. That's one of the reasons I am a fan of annuitization.
Yeah.
I know the younger you isn't. But again, to talk about my dad, and I did a whole show, literally, I think the day I found out that he passed away, I recorded, or it was the day after, I can't remember, but it was a tough show for me to do. But those of you who listened heard that show. And I shared some items of wisdom from my dad. And one of the things was, yes, he could not do fractions. It was in his early 80s that he admitted to me he had no idea what I was talking about when I was talking about fractions. And it had something to do with football, because you're talking about the New England Patriots. I'll always remember that. I have no idea what and how you talk to your dad about football and you're talking about fractions. But somehow I did. But not only that, he didn't understand investments much. He never did to begin with. But he certainly did it in his 80s. But Chris, I know you know the answer to this. He knew what happened on the third Wednesday of every month, did he not?
He did. That's when his Social Security check hit the checking account.
Exactly. And when you annuitize, whether it's a pension, Social Security, or the God-forbidden single premium immediate annuity, which are the ones we favor, but you buy an income annuity, you don't need to worry about those assets, the management of those assets, or God forbid you pass away and your spouse knows even less than you do, takes over, because your spouse or you as you age will remember whatever day of the month, quarter, or year your annuity check arrives. And as Chris rightly pointed out, you get the added benefit of longevity insurance. You happen to die much later than you thought. Checks just keep coming. But it's for the simplicity factor and, of course, the longevity factor that I prefer the annuitization of shortages in your minimum dignity floor of food, utilities, transportation, housing, and health care. And I wasn't going to read the last sentence this gentleman wrote, but after listening to Chris, I'm going to. And we might go a little bit deeper into this one dialogue question. We'll do the rest another time. We'll get to at least one more. But he wrote at the end, he said also, as the executor of my parents' estate, I want my estate to be as easy as possible for my heirs to manage. Having multiple accounts and MIGAs and QLEX and all the rest seem like a nightmare to unravel, especially if I become the other guy while my kids are busy raising their own kids and careers. I will go so far as to argue having an annuity paying you a lifetime stream of income designed to take care of your minimum dignity floor. And even if I'm going to equate the other guy right now, not to dying, but becoming cognitively declined or suffering a stroke or a heart attack or, gosh, what's that disease that Michael J. Fox has? I apologize.
Parkinson's.
I can't remember.
Parkinson's.
Parkinson's. Any of these types of conditions that cause you slowly or immediately to become dependent on someone else helping to manage your life and your finances, steady stream of income is a heck of a lot easier for your kids to step into. And in the case of your death and having to manage your estate, two of the three items you listed accounts, MIGAs and QLEX. Let's look at MIGAs and QLEX. They are insurance policies. They don't pass by probate, folks. They pass by right of law. Now, in the case of a single premium immediate annuity or a QLEX that is in the payout phase, depending on how you structured those payouts to end at your death, or end after all the money you put into them or paid out, irrespective of which option there you chose, at your death, it's out of your kids' hands. If it ends at your death, those payments just stop. There's nothing your kids need to do. Short of telling the insurance companies you've passed away, they will eventually figure it out because they pull the death rolls from Social Security on a regular basis. But your children, the worst they have to do is contact the insurance companies and say, Mom or Dad has passed. If your payout option was a cash refund, and not all your money has been returned to you, as soon as you pass away, the remaining dollars will be paid out to whoever the beneficiary was. Could be your very children who are helping to be executor of your estate, could be a charity, could be a favorite podcast host. Who knows who the money is left to, but it's on the beneficiary form. Those accounts pass by right of law and are quite easy for your children to handle. For accounts in general, IRA accounts, 401k accounts, other types of retirement accounts also pass by right of law and who is on the beneficiary designation form. Now, inappropriately completed beneficiary designation forms can create a headache to children. Yes. So it's going to be important that you at least update those on a regular basis. Remaining accounts that are not passing by right of law are generally accounts that would lend themselves quite well to revocable living trust. Could be real estate you own, could be your own home, could be rental properties, land, vacation homes, could be brokerage accounts, bank accounts. All of those can be titled during your life to a revocable living trust. As Shelley has said on this show, the estate planning attorney from Denver who's been on, as Pete has said on this show many a times, and he may come back on the show sometime this month. We're trying to pull him out of retirement. But as they have said, these types of accounts can be titled during your life to a revocable living trust or utilized with a proper will, I'll concede, but I'm trying to keep this simple, maybe a little bit more complex during your life to create a revocable living trust than it would be to create a will. But once the revocable living trust is set up, it's pretty much on autopilot and everything's titled appropriately to it. Chris, people die. Do trusts die?
They do not. They don't have an ending date.
They don't. There's trustees, and a properly worded and constructed revocable living trust will have people named as trustees and co-trustees and other ways to have some type of trustee in there, and you're not going to have a court-appointed one. The trustees handle the trust based on what you specified in them. And it can make any type of estate mitigation easier, especially folks. And I hear a lot of times, I used to be anti-revocable living trust. Not totally anti, but I always looked at a jaundiced eye when attorneys would just always go to the revocable living trust, revocable living trust, revocable living trust. And I feel there are some states, Colorado's allegedly one of them, where probate is easy. And if you live in that state, your child lives in that state, your child's right down the street from you, your child has a good understanding of everything going on, and it's an easy state to die in, okay, you might not need a revocable living trust. But what if your kid is as smart as Einstein, but you live in Colorado and the kid lives in England? How easy do you think it's going to be for him or her to probate your estate now? Or what if they just live 2,000 miles away in Maine, Bangor, Maine, and you're in Denver, Colorado? It's not as easy anymore. And an RLT, Revocable Living Trust, would have made life a hell of a lot easier. So there are things you can do to simplify the estate for your children. And the other advantage to revocable living trust is if you don't die, but you're incapacitated. Try being incapacitated. Well, you don't want to try this at home if you don't have to. But if you were incapacitated and your child is now stepping in, waving a power of attorney form, let me tell you, they are going to run into more headaches than you ever imagined. But if everything is in a revocable living trust, and your kid is the trustee, Chris, is that going to be an issue now? Because the trusts become disabled?
Should be no problem, because nothing has changed pre or post disability or whatever has happened to the original.
Right, just a trustee of the trust has changed.
Right, exactly.
That's it. Mm-hmm. Everything titled to the revocable living trust can be managed by your kid easily. They're now the trustee. Now, the custodian may ask for proof that they're the trustee.
Yeah.
But outside of that, that's it. So there are ways to make these things simpler. But don't look at MIGAs and QLACs and SPIAs and the IRAs and 401ks as difficult. They're actually quite easy. The beneficiary form can make it difficult, especially naming a trust as beneficiary of IRAs and things like that, but we won't get into that. But revocable living trust for non-IRA-type assets or insurance-type assets, or what we like to say assets that pass by right of law, could be a good thing, even if you live in a state where it's told you, oh, probate's so easy, so inexpensive, don't worry about it. Because if you became incapacitated, it's much easier for the trustee of that trust, assuming all your assets were titled appropriately to the trust. That's the biggest mistake people make with RLTs. They don't title things to the trust. The trustee can easily manage those assets. Nothing changes. Trusts don't die. Trusts can stop someday. They can't go on into perpetuity. But for the most part, trusts don't unexpectedly get hit by a bus and die. They can just keep going, and they don't become disabled. And a good attorney will word it that there'll always be a trustee or a way to get a trustee of those trusts. And then the trustee steps in and follows the directions that you laid out when you were more cognitively able to say, here's what I want these assets to do.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we beat that horse to death, but anything else you want to add to that?
No, not on this one.
Perfect. All right. This one gets into a little more planning one, so let's dive into this one. It says, hello, Jim and Chris. We're going to skip the state because, first of all, this is an EDU show, and second of all, on the Q&A shows, we fired ChatGPT, so Chris walloped ChatGPT, mostly because ChatGPT kept cheating.
I was going to say, it's only because I didn't cheat. That made me the default winner.
Oh, God, it's so cute. Every time I busted Chat for cheating, he'd admit it, and it's like, damn it, I won't do it again. But he does. He turns around and does it again. All right, anyways, I'll have to come up with another way to pit Chat against Chris, see if there's a way we can do this. All right, he begins. I'm a VGer and currently updating my Excel spreadsheets. Oh, God, that's perfect for the listeners of our show. For a 2038 retirement. Now, right off the bat, you might be thinking, nope, why are we even doing this? Chris says he likes to do plans for people 5 years or less from retirement.
Well, let me clarify. A detailed cash flow-based plan needs to be done fairly close. That doesn't mean you don't do any planning whatsoever. I think making general plans and rough sketches and how am I doing towards, you know, a goal that I've built for myself, things like that. So there's some thought to planning prior to that. You don't come in cold, not having thought about it at all. But to get into the level of detail that we do with our style of approach, where we're trying to identify very specific things like the size of your minimum dignity floor and where you're going to be living and what your dream is of what you want to do early in retirement. A lot of these things, you need to be close enough to have the clarity to put together the numbers. And that's where my 5 year out from retirement rule generally comes from. So I just wanted to clarify that.
All right. And I'm glad you did. And this is going to be part of the answer that I thought you would give. I know you don't know the questions yet. But he is, believe it or not, Chris, because he's that far out from retiring. It's 2038. Now, he wrote this, I think. No, he wrote it this year in 2025. So it's still 13 years from now. But he is actually trying to project his retirement using our approach now, even though he's not going to retire for 13 years. My encouragement, before I read any more of his email, for someone 13, 15, 20 plus years from retirement, I would actually be okay if they did more of a Monte Carlo probability statistic projection, merely to keep things simple. Because trying to project cash flow that you're going to have 13 years from now on day one of retirement, and then trying to project that cash flow 10, 20, 30 years into the future, again, using Chris's analogy or mine of whether you're driving or boating in the fog, trying to see 8 miles across town in a fog-ridden car or 800 yards across a lake in a fog-ridden rowboat is impossible. But seeing a few feet or a few hundred feet in front of your car or boat is quite easy. The further away, the less accurate the numbers. So that's where Monte Carlo, I'll give credence to a safe withdrawal Monte Carlo approach. It's so dumbed down. It's so simplified. I hate it for actual distribution planning. Despise it. But I think it's fairly good and reasonable and okay for an accumulation person, which this gentleman clearly is. But he's also a VG-er, spreadsheet, number-crunching guy, and he might be bored with simple Monte Carlo probability-based statistic. So I'll continue with his email. I'm a VG-er, and I'm currently updating my Excel spreadsheets to plan for 2038 retirement using your secure income method. I will be 68 at the time, and my wife will be 54. I have a $40,000 per year pension with a 100% survivor benefit. I anticipate the following. I have no idea if it's $40,000 today, folks, or into the future. I'm just reading his email verbatim. In 2038, this is what he projects, folks. He will have $2.4 million, very close to the $2.8 million that Chris and I often reference. $2.4 million. My minimum dignity floor will be $68,000. My delay period, that's the period between when he retires at 60 and when his Social Security begins at 70. His wife will only be 54. Hers won't begin, well, could actually begin in 10 years as well if she does the spousal. He doesn't give any information on who's claiming what or what the claiming strategy is. But he's saying his delay period between when he retires in 2038 and when all his secure income is turned on will be $330,000. He's also gone ahead and projected what his post-delay need will be. That is the reserve that he needs to put aside to allow the older him at some point in the future. He doesn't tell us when his crossover point is. Remember that concept, folks. When his delay period is over, when that $330,000 has been consumed, it's going to coincide with the time that all his secure income is turned on. Now, he doesn't tell us if the crossover period is immediate or later, but the crossover period, at least in the verbiage that we use, references the time when all your secure income is turned on, the time that your remaining minimum dignity floor expenses exceed your secure income. When that crosses over, that's when you need more secure income. He's saying his reserve for that is $500,000. Again, his numbers, not ours. I am also planning for $400,000 of long-term care reserve and a $100,000 buffer. Our paid-off home at our death will go to our children. So that's his inheritance, will be his home, which he says is paid off. I don't know if it's paid off now or will be in the future. By my calculations, this should leave us about a $1 million fun number. Here's my questions for you and Chris. For our delay period, would I fund that using a 10-year multi-year guaranteed annuity or a SPIA, or just use the cash? I'll let Chris answer that one because I know which one I would prefer, but I'll let Chris answer that one.
First, a SPIA, that's a regular series of payments. So for this, he'd be considering a 10-year SPIA that just takes his lump sum amount and pays him yearly. I think that's overkill and painting you into a corner where you lose the liquidity of having access to dollars, knowing that even though you've projected expenses being pretty even every year, you might find that they're not so even. So you need a little more flexibility than just accessing, you know, roughly 1/10 of it every year. So I probably wouldn't go the SPIA route. MIGAs can be useful in a 10-year delay period because that's a long enough period where you could slice it up. If his delay period was 2 or 3 years, I'd say just keep it all in cash. A 10-year period, there is some room to do some positioning where you might have a 2-3 year period of just plain old cash to keep it super simple, and then have a MIGA or two that matures at the 3-year mark and then maybe at the 6-year mark, something like that to give you the principal protection. and, you know, a locked in interest rate you could rely on that's, you know, generally pretty competitive in the current interest rate environment. So, I could see where you could use that. The MYGA does not pay out. So it's just a accumulation or a growth over a period of time event. So you're going to want those to liquefy in plenty of time for you to have access to dollars to spend them. Or you could keep it out and manage it hyper conservatively. And again, keeping, you know, 2 to 3 years worth of cash is our general rule, or cash equivalents. And then I've seen people effectively that don't want to do MYGAs deal with high yield savings accounts or other types of principal protection. Although with a 10-year delay period, there's maybe the funding for years 6 through 10 could maybe take on a little bit of risk if you were open to that, if that was kind of your style. But we generally want to protect that minimum dignity floor very aggressively, if you will. So, which means not leaving it aggressively invested, kind of the opposite of that. You want to make sure those dollars are there. So I think you could use, you know, some blend in that era, in that 10-year period, but I'm not probably the least attracted to the SPIA choice.
Yeah, I agree. We generally don't recommend SPIA-tizing the delay period MDF. Because the true benefit of a SPIA is the fact that the payments can go full life. Now, you can set a period certain, say, hey, I only want these payments for 5 or in this case, 10 years. But the downside to utilizing a SPIA on that is, first of all, you bought an annuity. Those dollars are off limits. You can't get to them. And your minimum dignity floor shortage is not going to be linear. It's not going to be the same amount every year, steadily growing at a certain rate. It's going to be all over the place. Again, the projections we do in your plan is just benefiting from the law of large numbers. It's not saying this is the exact amount. We can give you a dollar amount that the analysis projects, but I'm telling you now, it's wrong. And you might end up spending in 1 year $5,000 or $10,000 more than what you projected your MDF needs to be in the following year, $2,000 or $3,000 less. It's all over the place. And if you spiatize MDF delay period, and you're taking a steady stream of payments, that might not be enough in any given year. I would much rather manage it individually. And because it has that end date, it's fairly easy to do.
Right.
Okay. So then he continues. So he says, where is it? Okay. For the post-delay period, remember, he needs $500,000, folks. Would I just set aside the $500,000? Well, he puts $500,000. And since the $500,000 is a long time away, would I actually need a total of $500,000 to fund the post-delay? I think what he's asking there, Chris, and I'll let you answer this part because this is a calculation you do all the time. Would he need, he doesn't tell us when his crossover point begins, folks. We know if the first 10 years, that's his delay period. Let's just assume, Chris, his crossover is 8 years after that. So 18 years after he starts retirement, if he did the calculation correctly, he's saying 18 years after he retires, he's going to need $500,000. Mm-hmm. That's nominal. That's not needing to be adjusted for inflation. He's done the calculations. He will need $500,000 in 18 years to generate the income he needs. Now, hopefully, he's not going to rely on one calculation he did in 2025 to come up with that number, and he's going to update it on a regular basis, as we've already said. But do you feel, Chris, yes or no, and help this guy out? When he retires in 10 years, does he put $500,000 aside? Or how should he consider? He needs $500,000 18 years from when he retires. How should he handle that?
Well, how he arrived at that $500,000 is critical. So we're just going to have to trust that he did that appropriately and that nominally. So transport yourself 18 years into the future in the way Jim's described this. Standing on that date in 18 years, you need $500,000. Not $500,000 in today's terms that needs to grow because of inflation, but rather you truly need $500,000. At that point, then you need to look at what I need to set aside today to have $500,000 in 18 years reliably, right? So reliably over 18 years, My guess is even if you assumed a rather conservative rate of return, that you're likely, and I'm just off the top of my head, saying you might need maybe set aside $300,000 today. But you could do a calculation based on what rate of return you feel comfortable that you could achieve over that 18-year period. And because this is for minimum dignity floor, we tend to use a fairly conservative assumption for rate of return for these particular dollars, because again, we're all about creating a foundation to your retirement of protecting that minimum dignity floor. So we want to take very little risk with dollars that are supposed to be used for minimum dignity floor, even if you've got an 18-year time horizon. Arguably, that is a long period of time. So you could invest it somewhat traditionally up to a certain degree of your risk tolerance. But we usually encourage people, for determining what to set aside today, let's assume conservative and then monitor it. And then if things go better over the first 10 years or so, and it's grown above and beyond what you might need, or it's on track to do so, maybe you can scrape a few of those dollars over and take an extra vacation or something like that. Yeah, but for now, on day one of retirement, let's play it pretty safe in this regard. But no, he wouldn't have to set aside the full 500 because he's not putting it in a box under his mattress. He's likely to earn at least some rate of return on that. So he could set aside less than that. Now, if his 500,000 is all based on 2025 dollars, his need in 18 years is going to be a heck of a lot bigger than 500,000. And he needs to make sure that he is setting aside enough that will actually accomplish that. So just it all hinges on how he came up with that 500,000, if that's nominal or in today's dollars.
Okay. Then he asks rhetorically, but I think he's asking same question, but applied to LTC. Mm-hmm. So here, folks, things would be different. You see, with a delay period, a post-delay period need, and again, we had to make some assumptions in our discussion, so it's not directly answering his question, but he can divine what we're getting at. He's going to retire, and we're saying 8 years after his delay period MDF expires is his crossover point. That's where he needs a $500,000. We're also assuming that $500,000 is what he actually needs in 18 years. It's not $500,000 today growing at inflation. That's why we're comfortable assigning that reserve, that position, a discount rate. And we use, as Chris said, 3%. We could use 4, we could use 5, we could use 8, we could use 27. We chose to be conservative. I would rather the older you get pissed at the younger you for having too much money than the older you getting upset at the younger you for not leaving them enough. So by utilizing a discount rate, then you can start to invest your dollars. And if you can meet or preferably beat a 3% discount rate, it all but assures you should have, notice I said should, not will, but should have sufficient assets in 18 years to fund your post delay minimum dignity floor needs after your crossover point. Again, updating those numbers on a consistent basis, maybe not every year, but consistent until they're needed. But LTC is different. He wants $400,000. It's nice for us to say, I'm not going to need it till I'm 87. Jim's dad didn't need it until he was 89. I had a stroke at 57 that should have killed me or paralyzed me. As you all know, it did neither. But it could have. And what if it paralyzed me? I would have needed LTC at 57. That $400,000 reserve he wants, we personally would not discount it because he has to say, well, I'm not going to need it until 86. So I have 22 years from when I retire. No, he's retiring what, at 60. I have 26 years before I'm going to need it. How does he know? And then he's going to sit there and say, if I earn 3% on that, I can discount it down. I only need to put 200 something aside. And what if he did it that way? And he only put $220,000 aside, and he spent his fund number to his heart's content. And then at 76, he suffers an LTC need and needs that money, and he's nowhere near what he needed. You need $400,000 or you want $400,000 for LTC because it can be needed at any time, you put that $400,000 aside. Or you pass that risk on to an insurance company through insurance, and you just put the premiums aside or build the premiums into your MDF cash flow, and you might have to adjust your delay period and post-delay period MDF needs. But if you need $400,000 and want $400,000, you don't have a discount rate. You have a TSIR, T-S-I-R, Targeted Spending Inflationary Rate. He should put that $400,000 aside and track the cost of living adjustment for LTC expenses in his part of the country. Genworth does a very good job on coming out with this data, and you can get it from Genworth. I don't like Genworth as a company. I don't feel it's fiscally and financially sound. I'll give it credit for trying to improve itself, but it dug itself into an LTC abyss by grotesquely underpricing policies that were sold 15, 20 plus years ago. And it's Genworth with their outrageous premium increases that they do on a consistent and regular basis on these old policies that have tainted the industry and unfortunately got people, some very intelligent advisors that I know of who keep spouting, oh, you don't want to buy LTC insurance today. I have clients whose premiums have gone up 20, 30, 40% a year and are going to do that based on a letter we received from the insurance company for the next 4, 5, 6 years. They're touting Genworth and policies that were sold decades ago under underwriting parameters that are not even close to being used today. So my point is Genworth knows a lot about LTC, and I may not feel comfortable when I see a Genworth LTC policy, but I do trust their data on costs. Who better to know what the hell LTC costs than the largest provider of LTC benefits? Like them or not, they pay out more than any insurance company on LTC benefits. They know what it costs in various parts of the country. So you can get what your TSIR is, Targeted Spending Inflationary Rate, for your part of the country. And that $400,000 reserve needs to meet or beat that TSIR going forward. So when you do need those dollars, whether it's 5 years from now or 25 years from now, it has grown at a rate that is keeping pace with the LTC needs in your area at that time. So we don't discount it down and say, leave a lesser amount. You're not going to need it until 85 or 86 or 82, some random age you choose, because you very well may need it a lot sooner. Now, a little bit about the TSIR, it can change and you should monitor it on a regular basis. And you don't need to earn it, and you can't earn it every year unless your TSIR is, say, some number, I don't want to give one, but some reasonable number, and you can buy a MIG. We've had clients do this. You can get a multi-year guaranteed annuity for 3 years, 5 years. We generally don't recommend 10 years, but you could go if you want as long as 10 years. Maybe the guaranteed interest rate of that MIGA is already greater than your TSIR, and it makes you feel better to do that. We prefer to invest aging and long-term care dollars, but I'm saying your aim with the TSIR is to meet or beat it, but also recognize, especially if those dollars are invested, you're not going to do that every single year. You may underperform for a year or two and then dramatically overperform. But as long as you average between now and when you need it, a rate of return equal to or greater than, preferably greater than, your TSIR, you should have on an inflation-adjusted basis that $400,000 that you wanted. Mm-hmm. Anything you want to add to that, Chris?
No, I think that's the right way to look at it. At least that's the way we prefer to look at it.
Okay, so then he just wraps up. He says, I understand all this has to do with your positioning, but I think this is by far the most complex part of your process. I would love to hear more podcasts on positioning in the future. Well, you just heard three recently, right, and we most likely will be doing more. But I want to key in on something, Chris, that this guy said, complex, and it ties into what the other gentleman said. This is tough. This is complex. I want to keep it easy for my beneficiaries or for my heirs. I know you guys are all do-it-yourselfers, and that's great. But I do believe there comes a point in everyone's life where they're going to have to hire a professional firm to assist them. And this is not a shout out to hire us. It takes a while to hire us. We have a wait if you want to become a client of ours. So we're not trying to say, hey, hire us. You can hire anybody you want. But I do feel at some point in your life, even you VG do-it-yourselfers, you're going to have to hire a financial firm to help navigate your retirement. The problem is, and I fully support you on this, you don't want to hire an AUMer, and I don't blame you. You paying 1% or more of your assets to some godforsaken firm who views you more as an asset gathering device, and they're going to throw you in some cookie cutter portfolio, even they're going to swear to your face it's not cookie cutter, and they're going to draw some sort of ongoing asset management fee out of it, that's not what you need. But at some point in time, you may have to hire a firm that truly does distribution planning, will charge a fixed and flat fee, irrespective of the size of your assets, will integrate everything you need, will know everything about you, will be able to convey to your heirs or your beneficiaries, if you're not quite dead yet, or to your agents under a POA or trustees of your revocable living trust, what you're doing, how you're doing it, where the dollars are, what your traditional spending is. A company that's going to be able to monitor and say, wow, George had a trustee step in under his trust and help him, or an agent under a POA because of some cognitive decline. But we can't help but notice ever since that's happened, his spending has gone up twofold from where it's been over the last 15 years. Something might not be quite right. Who is his trusted contacts we can reach out to? Wow, there's no trusted contact. Or the trusted contact is the very person who all of a sudden it seems to be magically spending twice as much as he's ever spent when he was alive. And these expenses seem to be in excess of what the needs are. Maybe we should get a hold of the sheriff's department or elderly services in his county and see if everything is okay, or see if they could do a discussion with this agent. That's the kind of service you guys are going to need. And there could come a time where you just have to factor this in. The best analogy I can give is myself. I've spent the last 26 years growing this firm, and I've shared openly, my butterfly is not out yet. The firm is not quite where I want it to be, but I know over the coming years it will be. I don't know if we're 2 years away or 5 years away. Things seem to work a lot slower than I would prefer them to be, but I'm that methodical in doing it. But I know when my firm is set up like that, yes, I'm good. It's a shout out to my firm. You think I'm going to hire someone else? Of course not. I will hire whoever takes over my firm to help manage my retirement. Even though I've done this for a living, I know I can't forever. And I'm going to need to make sure there is a firm there that is watching everything I just shared with you. Because I know I could be taken advantage of in the future, especially because I have no spouse. But even if I did, I don't know if she is going to be cognitively able, and maybe someone we name to help us is ripping us off. I need someone who's going to say, God, for 12 years, Jim has always been spending this much, and now they have this agent under POA. Just where's all that money going? Someone who's going to raise a red flag. Someone who I've already granted that ability to do. Specifically. Please do watch. And if you feel something nefarious is going on, I'm signing right here. You have every right to contact the authorities and ask them. Sooner or later, you have to pass on something that you have spent your whole life doing because you know at a point in time you can't. You know, as dumb as analogy this is going to sound like, I tell myself every year, not too long ago, not this past Saturday, but last Saturday, I was splitting some more firewood. I cut, gather, and split my own firewood and have been doing that for 26 years, ever since moving to Colorado. And actually, prior to moving to Colorado for a few years when I lived in my grandparents' home, I gathered, cut, and split firewood when I lived there because I heated with firewood then. I just enjoy it. I enjoy the physical activity. I enjoy heating with wood. It's nice. I love it. But I was just thinking again. I don't know how much longer I'm going to be able to do this. My back hurts more. My shoulders hurt more. I can't bend over. My heavy chainsaw feels wicked heavy. And I'm thinking, you know, Jim, sooner or later, especially if you move to Ohio, where I'm not lifting cottonwood for Pete's sakes, they call it cottonwood because it throws off this crap-ass stuff of cotton that gets everywhere, but it's also as light as cotton when it's dry. And I'm picking up pretty big things of cottonwood logs and splitting them. And I'm thinking, God, if I live in Ohio, this is going to be oak. I'm not going to be able to lift this. There's going to come a time in my life where I'm going to have to pass on to someone else gathering, cutting, splitting my firewood. Even though I did it myself for years, I know I'm not going to be able to do it forever. And that's going to happen to all of you. And yes, you might be able to find family and friends, but if they're the same age as you, that's not going to do you any good. Or if it's your children, as the other person said, what if it's my children and they're right in the middle of raising their own kids and working their own job? You think they're going to have time to handle this for you? Might be time to eventually pass it on to a firm that specializes in distribution planning, a firm that's not going to be more interested in gathering your assets and charging an uncapped AUM fee, promising you that they're going to do all this crap, but you know and I know all they're trying to do is gather your assets and take it from you. That's all these companies do. And I'll go on a tirade about private equity in my industry and all the crap that AUMers do in the future. As you can tell, I can't stand it. But you can find firms that will approach and just do distribution planning, charge fixed fees, and take a concerted effort and interest in you and being your advocates for when you need it. You might not need it now. I don't need help with my firewood now, but I know in time I will. Anything you want to add with that, and I apologize, folks, and apologize, Chris, for going down a little bit of a rabbit hole there, but anything you want to add to that, Chris, you've been doing this not quite as long as me, but for a long time. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I do think that's worthy. That kind of goes hand in hand with keeping it simple. I mentioned you might have people helping you, so you want it to be simple for that, in addition to being simple for the older you. But again, the younger you can put things in place to help protect the older you. So having plans that, you know, identify early enough when you can identify them, trusted individuals or firms that can help watch out for you later in life, because unfortunately, as people age, they become targets, either targets from, unknown strangers or targets from even family members that, will take advantage of their financial situation. So, it's worthy of paying some attention to that when you're younger and you can put some plans in place. I fully agree with that.
And Chris, you do the planning in the office along with Jake and Keely and the data gathering. This is something you ask them. You ask them specifically, do you want us to factor in a cost of managing your retirement? Do you not?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's definitely something to be considered because I think it's an expense, just like anything else. So if you're not building that in, you're just ignoring some expense that you're going to have in the future. So if you intend to have someone or you'd like to prepare or plan to have for someone to provide you additional aid, it's just like having someone do some shopping for you or chopping wood for you. If you want to plan to have somebody doing some more planning for you, and management of assets or other related things that you're doing now on your own, you should build that into your projections. I mean, it is going to be an expense that you don't incur today because you're doing it yourself, just like you're chopping your own wood. It's something that should be part of the plan if that's your intentions. And even if you're not sure, I'd probably throw it in there just so you, there's a lot of expenses we include that people aren't incurring right now that we want to be prepared for. And so since we take a rather conservative approach to planning and projections, we usually err on the side of adding things. If it's, you know, if you're not sure, well, let's go ahead and put it in there just so you know that that it's been accounted for and it won't surprise you later. It's better to be prepared than have a surprise expense that you weren't anticipating having to cover. So I do think you should build that in if that's on your radar at all.
Exactly. And that's something that we specifically ask people. Should we build this in? If so, approximately when? Because we recognize this is an expense that I personally, and it's not just because I own a retirement planning firm, I feel everybody's going to need one. And not an AUM firm. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a true retirement distribution firm that's going to do everything that I just shared with you. I just know at some point in time, you have no choice. And if I live long enough, I'm going to have to hire people to take care of me. And I'm not too proud of that and happy, nor am I looking forward to it. But as long as I can still enjoy whatever my life looks like then, I know someday I might have to hire people to do my laundry, maybe even to dress me. Hopefully not feed me or wipe me, but you get the picture. It's disgusting. It's terrible how we age. But I know things that I do now on my own, I can't in the future. Don't be so proud to think that at some point in time, you can't do this and that there's something wrong with you. It's not. It's just a natural progression that at some point in time, you need to hire someone. And if I was my best analogy, and I think of this constantly because I say to myself, think of all the money you have saved over the past 26 years, 30 plus if you count the time in Massachusetts at my grandparents, and hopefully still another 5, 6, 7 years, I don't know, before I finally pull the plug and hire someone who cut and split and dried the firewood already for me. Think of all the money that I saved over the years doing it myself. It's now time to hire that out. But I'm still so far ahead. Yes, I still have to pay for it. But I've earned that 9 times over by doing it myself while I could. Someday, someone will manage my retirement. It won't be me. Someday, I'm going to be hiring someone to come deliver firewood and stack it for me. It won't be me. But I've done it myself for so long, I've saved a hell of a lot of money already. Sooner or later, it's just going to become an expense.
Yep.
All right. I think that is a good place to wrap up. Yep. I had 2 other emails I wanted to get to. We won't next week because we have Kevin coming on, and mm-hmm. Kevin will probably be here for 2 weeks in a row. And yours truly will actually be in Atlanta and Ohio. I never really mentioned that to anybody, but I will be flying out next week on May 14th to Atlanta, Georgia, to go to the Ed Slot program for a 2-day Ed Slot training. That's the deep training. I have no idea what we're going to be going over, but I'm sure we'll have the things that make you go, after like I do, and Chris seems to enjoy, and maybe some other cute things that Ed might share with us. So I will be in Georgia from the 14th to the 16th, and then I'm going to head to Ohio for a couple of days, a few things I have to wrap up with my apartment. So I'll probably be in Ohio till around the 20th or 21st. And then I have to get back to Colorado because I'm knee deep in the middle of my planting season and I want to get everything for my garden in. So because of that, my ability to do the EDU show and the Q&A show will be greatly reduced, if not eliminated. And that's why Kevin, who's coming on next week, may stay on actually for 2 shows for us. And then staff and Chris can do a Q&A show without yours truly. But couple little programming changes going forward. But okay. That's about it, Chris. Just wanted to let everyone know. I usually talk about my travels weeks in advance, but I totally forgot to mention to everyone that I will be in Atlanta and then Ohio for a few days.
Okay. Well, sounds good. Well, I want to thank everybody, the contributors today, who emailed us these great emails that we could discuss. We've got more in the bag, so we'll have another opportunity to do this down the road. Looking forward to having Kevin on next week. Hope you all enjoy it. I'm sure that you will. And everyone stay safe. And we appreciate you listening, continuing to listen, and send in questions as needed. If you want to send in any questions or comments, send them to Jim directly. jim@jimhelps.com is the email address. Put in the subject line that it's a question or comment for the podcast. Include a word or two about the topic. That's always helpful. And we'll do our best to address your question or comment on a future show. So we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jim, H-E-L-P-S.com, or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.